There's a well-known statement, I believe that some attributed to the Rebbe Nishma Seidim, the Rebbe Rashab, that whoever believes all the stories that are told about the Baal Shem Tov is a fool. The reason for that being because many of the tales of the Baal Shem Tov became part of folklore and were embellished, or some of them were even made up. So to believe them all would be to be foolish. However, if one, so the statement continues, does not believe that they could have happened, then that person could be deemed a heretic, because all the tales that are told of the Baal Shem Tov were certainly within the realm of possibility that the Baal Shem Tov could have performed these wonderful and wondrous deeds. In fact, we heard many times from the Rebbe how the Rebbe would say about the Maisa, about the story, Ich hab das nicht gehört von Schwer, Chassidim erzählen, ich hab das nicht gehört von Schwer, the Chassidim relate that, but I did not hear the story from my father-in-law, meaning from the previous Lubavitch Rebbe, and therefore, even in retelling it, the Rebbe would say that he cannot vouch for the authenticity of the story. At the same time, the Rebbe would say that the Baal Chassidim erzählen does, since it is being told and commonly retold, therefore there must be some germ and truth to it. The reason for this introduction is because in this installment and the next installment, Emir Tzashem will be telling the story about the Baal Shem Tov's journey to Eretz Yisroel. And here there are a number of versions. There's one which is the more common version, which will tell first, and God willing, in the next installment will tell some of the other versions. And that is why that cautionary note, which is given in general with regard to some of the more, shall we say, outlandish stories of the Baal Shem Tov, parenthetically, which we have made sure or tried to see that the stories that we tell come from authentic sources. But in a situation where there are different versions, and of course only one of these versions happened, so we'll bear in mind that some of these versions have a greater degree of authenticity than the others do. As I said, the first story which will be told is the one which is most common and which has the greatest degree of veracity, it would seem. First version goes that it was already 2 days before Pesach when the Baal Shem Tov and his daughter Odal arrived in Istanbul in Turkey on their way to Eretz Yisrael. This alone was not the only reason to make them stay in that city, for when they arrived exhausted and penniless after the hardship of an arduous journey, there was further exacerbated these extreme situations by the Baal Shem Tov suddenly losing all of his heavenly powers, or which is called Katnus HaMeichin, that the gigantic spiritual intellect that the Baal Shem Tov would always enjoy at this time was thwarted from above. Baal Shem Tov turned to the only refuge he knew of, the Beis HaMedrash. He sat down and tried to study Torah, but his mind was beclouded and nothing would penetrate on the normal level where the Baal Shem Tov would enjoy his Limud HaTorah, his study of Torah. Meanwhile, Odal, penniless and forlorn, made the best of her situation by taking her father's holiday clothing down to the sea to wash, there being nothing else she could do in preparation for the coming Yom Tov. She sat by a rock, scrubbing and weeping, feeling utterly forsaken as she contemplated her and her father's prospects for Pesach without a roof over their head, without into the Istanbul port. Among the people who debarked, who came off the ships, was a wealthy merchant who had noticed the weeping maiden from afar. Touched by her sorrow, he approached her and asked what was troubling her. Odal replied that, "My father is a very famous and holy tzaddik, a holy man, who has had all his spiritual powers taken away from him right now. Here we are alone in Istanbul, and I have no idea what will become of us, for we have no provisions for Yontif, which is about to approach. And she said this in tears and in great sorrow. Go, bring your father to my house, where you can both spend the holiday in comfort, the merchant bade the girl, handing her a card which bore his address. Adol hurried to the Beis HaMedrash to tell her father the good news that they had a place where to stay for Pesach. Together they made their way to the merchant's luxurious home, where they were made to feel welcome. After refreshing themselves with drink, they were shown to their quarters. The Baal Shem Tov promptly went to sleep in anticipation of the evening Seder. In other places, I believe it's told, I believe in Sippur Chassidim, when the story is told, it says that the Baal Shem Tov, having been starved, being Erev Pesach, was very thirsty, and he drank quite a large amount of wine, because a large amount is not massive. And so you could eat the Seder with relish, and he slept for a number of hours. Meanwhile, his host went to shul for the evening prayer. Seeing that the Baal Shem Tov had still not awoken upon his return, the merchant called Adol to him. Go and wake your father, it is getting late, and we must begin the Seder. I would not wake my father for anything in the world, the girl replied, horrified. Very well. I will have to rouse him myself, said the host. The merchant entered the bedroom and approached the bed where the Baal Shem Tov, the holy Baal Shem, was sleeping. Suddenly, the merchant drew back in awe. The figure before him, the Baal Shem, was glowing fiercely. The Baal Shem Tov's eyes bulged from their sockets, while rivers of tears flowed from under the closed lids. His guest, he saw, was no simple man, the merchant was now convinced, as he retired from the room in awe to await the Baal Shem Tov getting up on his own. A short while later, the Baal Shem Tov awoke on his own accord, thoroughly refreshed. During his sleep, the Baal Shem Tov's spiritual powers had been fully returned to him, and he now turned to Tfilas Yontif, to the evening prayers of the holiday, with his usual fervor and devotion, which was a sight that further inspired and impressed his host. The Baal Shem Tov led the Seder in his usual inspiring fashion, singing and expounding in turn, while the merchant and Adol sat under his spell. At one point, the Baal Shem Tov departed from his usual custom when he came to the words in Hallel, Lo'is Neflois, that Hashem performs great wonders. At this point, the Baal Shem's voice rang out even more loudly and clearly than previously as he articulated the words with utter devotion. The sound carried out far into the stillness of the night. The rest of the Seder passed in previous fashion, but it was early morning by the time they had finished. Until now, the merchant had refrained from making any comments or asking any questions for fear of disturbing his godly visitor. But now that the Seder was over, the merchant ventured several comments. Why did you sing the Pasuk of Lois and Neflois, that you, God, perform such great wonders? Why did you sing that particular pasuk, that particular verse, so loudly? He asked. The Jews of Istanbul were in great danger, the Baal Shem Tov revealed. While I slept, my soul ascended to heaven, where I interceded with all my might on their behalf. At the very moment that I sang the Hallel so loudly, I was informed that the decree had been nullified. You will learn all about it tomorrow morning in shul. On the following morning, as the congregation was awaiting one of their trustees, he suddenly rushed in, one of the gaboyim, the man suddenly rushed in exclaiming, "Mazel tov, my good friends, congratulate yourselves on having escaped imminent danger, Baruch Hashem, thank be the Almighty." Everyone crowded around to hear the details of his surprising announcement. "As you may well know," the man began, "our late Sultan was in the habit of dressing in common clothing to walk unrecognized among his people. Many years ago, the late Sultan did just that. This particular stroll took him far out of the city limits, and before he realized what had happened, he was surrounded by a robber band. The Sultan was seized and brought to their hideout. After his pockets had been emptied of the several items of value they contained, the Sultan was confident that he would be released. Not so. The bandits informed him that they must now kill him, since he knew the location of their hideout. The Sultan contemplated his chances of survival. If I reveal my identity, I will surely be killed, for they could not possibly hope to gain anything by releasing me, because they'd be sure that I'd come after them. Let me use my wits instead and see if I cannot save my skin. I am trained with a particular skill which may bring you much profit," he told his captors. They perked up their ears in interest, while he went on to explain, "I know how to fashion valuable tapestries, given the proper raw materials. My products will fetch high prices for you on the market. Try and see. You'll gain nothing from killing me. You'll make a fortune by keeping me alive. It's to your benefit that I live." The robbers were willing, for the sake of profit, to give his plan a fair try. They purchased simple mats from which the Sultan fashioned his tapestry. After 2 days, the first product was ready for the market. The finished product did not overly impress the bandits, but the Sultan hastened to warn, "This tapestry can be appreciated only by true connoisseurs of art. Do not be daunted if at first people laugh at the price you ask. But by no means are you to settle for less than what I tell you. Go from shop to shop until you find the proper customer, a person who is expert enough to appreciate this work." And events transpired just as the captive had foretold. At the first place they entered, the bandits were greeted by jeers and hoots when they demanded an outlandish price for their merchandise. The scene was repeated at the next door and again at the next. By now, a large crowd of people had gathered to see the outcome of the farce. Who would be mad enough, they wondered, to pay the price these men were asking for what appeared to be a simple mat? "Just then, my father happened to walk by," says the gabbai, the trustee, telling the story, "attracted by the commotion. He learned from the people around me the cause of the gathering and pushed forward, sensing something strange. He was shown the merchandise and was quoted the ridiculous price. Here was clearly something deeper than met the eye, he was sure, as he asked the men to step into his shop so that he could examine the tapestry at his leisure. A quick look showed him that there was nothing especially artistic about the piece before him, save for one letter intricately woven and hidden in the cloth. 'I'll take it at your price,' my father told them, and went on to ask about the craftsman who had fashioned it. The men were reluctant to give him any further information. 'If you like this work, we can bring you more like it,' they promised, but that was all they would say. The bandits returned to their hideout with good news for the Sultan. Not only had his cloth been purchased at his price, but the customer wished to order more. The Sultan was certain that some clever person had caught on to his ruse and set about his work, carefully, ingeniously weaving in the second initial into the center of the cloth. When this cloth was brought to my father the next day, he knew that he had been right in assuming that it contained the clue. After paying the price, he hurried to the Sultan's palace with his tale. The place was in pandemonium. No one knew what had happened to the Sultan. Searches were being organized, but no trace or clue had come up as yet. When he presented his story to the proper authorities, it was agreed that the Sultan was trying to send a message as to his whereabouts. My father was told to hold his tongue, but continued to purchase the tapestries as they were brought. Day after day, the Sultan spelled out his name and then his location. Armed with the information, a battalion of soldiers were dispatched to the robber's hideout, where they succeeded in freeing the Sultan. The Sultan did not forget my father, his benefactor, and summoned him to the palace. "How can I thank you enough?" he said. "Name your reward and you will have it." My father refused to hear of a reward. "Is it not a reward enough that I have had the good fortune to save the life of my king? It is a privilege which is reward in itself." This was not enough for the Sultan, however. He made out a proclamation stating that he and his children would forever have the privilege of approaching him without previous permission. This all happened to my father many, many years ago. He never had cause to utilize his special privilege, being wealthy and influential in his own right. My father passed away, as did the former Sultan, but I found no cause all these years to seek access to the Sultan. This year, our Sultan happened to be walking through the marketplace with his vizier, with his chief advisor, a rabid anti-Semite, when he noticed a flurry of activity. Cartloads of funny-looking loaves were being transported from place to place. The Sultan had never seen anything like it. "What are these cakes?" he asked his companion. "These are called matzahs. They are eaten by the Jews throughout the holiday they call Passover. Some Jews pride themselves in eating only shmorah matzahs, or specially prepared unleavened cakes made from the blood of a Muslim child, which they slaughter for that purpose." The Sultan could not believe his ears. "Don't take my word for it, Your Majesty," the vizier said. "Make your own inquiries. You will hear the same story." The Sultan did ask around and learned that there were, in fact, many Jews who only ate the special loaves known as shmorah matzah, which were baked under the most careful supervision. And he inferred from this information that the vizier's comments, including the comments about the blood taken from a Muslim child, had all been true. He was horrified. He instituted a special inquiry to determine which Jews ate only shmorah matzah. These he intended to punish by royal decree, imprisoning them in a surprise raid on the morning after the Seder. On the eve of Erev Pesach, the wine merchant continued his tale, his audience hanging on to his every word. "I had a frightening dream. My father appeared to me to warn me of the impending danger. He instructed me to go straight to the Sultan by virtue of my special privilege of free entry and present the true version of the blood libel to acquit my fellow Jews. I was to expose the vizier to the Sultan for what he was, not a devout Muslim, as the Sultan thought, but a practicing Greek Orthodox Christian. Tell the Sultan to send his soldiers to the vizier's home in the middle of the night," my father instructed, "and they will find him in bed with a cross upon his chest." I awoke towards evening, deciding that the dream had been inconsequential, and set about with my preparations for the evening Seder. I was suddenly seized by a sudden heavy drowsiness. I fell asleep again, and my father appeared once more, warning me to heed his advice, for only I could save the community. When I awoke the second time, I could no longer shake off the dream as irrelevant. I realized that I must act at once. It was already late at night when I arrived at the Sultan's palace. Despite my my right to enter the palace when I wished. I was loath to bother the Sultan, who must surely have gone to sleep by now. Instead, I begged the palace guards to take me to the old queen, the late Sultan's wife. The queen admitted me and listened patiently to my story. I hastened to remind her that in all these years, neither my father nor I had used our privilege. If I was asking her to intercede for the Jews on my behalf, it was because the matter was one of life or death. The queen told me to wait while she went to speak to her son. She did not plan to present the Jews' cause, for she had heard nothing of the impending decree and thought it might not be true. Instead, she decided to tell her son she had dreamed that his father, the late Sultan, had appeared to her in a dream, instructing her to warn her son against issuing any evil decrees. At first, the young Sultan denied any impending evil decrees. When his mother mentioned the Jews, he confessed, "Yes, mother, but my law concerning the Jews is a beneficial one, for it concerns those Jews who use Muslim blood in their matzah baking. I have ordered this cult to be destroyed for the public benefit." Seeing that the Jew had spoken the truth, the queen now told the entire story to her son, who asked that the wine merchant be brought before him. I ran forward, throwing myself at his feet, my story pouring out in tearful pleas. I begged the Sultan to follow my father's suggestion of sending soldiers to surprise the vizier in his own home to prove that he was unfaithful to the Muslim religion. The Sultan followed my suggestion, and all proved as I had predicted. In their fury, the soldiers killed the vizier on the spot, returning to the Sultan with a report of their deed. The Sultan immediately canceled the wicked decree that would have killed us all, Khalilah, God forbid. That happened just about the time that I was saying the howl, did it not? The Baal Shem Tov asked the merchant. The statement was confirmed, for indeed the Baal Shem Tov had been aware of the miracle at the very minute that it happened, which coincided with his recital of Lois Nifloys Gedolus, that God truly makes wonderful miracles. May we all merit to see such miracles in our own days. The next two stories about the Baal Shem Tov's trip, or alternate versions, plus another story of what happened in Istanbul, Emir Tzashem, in the coming installment.